And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good evening, Phil.
Phil's show is Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. We're going to talk to Danny Haifong, who writes for Black Agenda Report, among others. And we're going to ask about his trip to Cuba and other matters. And later in the show, about the halfway point, we're going to be talking to Fred Jerome, author of The Einstein File, a very important book about J. Edgar Hoover and McCarthyism and the red baiting of Albert Einstein. We're going to be talking about this. There's a new mini-series, I guess you call it, produced by National Geographic, of all things. But that's owned by Murdoch.
It's owned by Murdoch.
We're all in bad shape. But I think, are we joined by, I think Danny Haifong is available. Are you there, Danny?
Yes, I am here. Hi.
Hey, Danny, thanks very much for talking to us. You've been writing really interesting essays. I want to ask you about a couple of them and your views on some matters. But I guess the one that I was really impressed with was you've made a trip to Cuba in May. Mm-hmm. And you wrote a piece titled "The Cuban Revolution is Still in Motion," and it included your writing. Was it an open letter to the Cuban people? I'm trying to remember how you formulated it, but there was many things to be learned. Let's go with that. What's your impression of Cuba? Had you been there before?
So I had not been there before. I had tried to go many times in the past, but have always been sidelined by something that goes on in the midst of living in a capitalist system in complete decline here in the United States. Something goes wrong, and it would make the trip and not possible. But I did get to go in May for a short time, less than a week, about 4.5 days. Mm-hmm. But even in that short time, I was able to see a lot. I met with a representative at the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the People. We talked for a few hours about all sorts of things, especially Cuba's continued commitment to solidarity with the African continent. Cuba sees itself as having a special role given the historic relationship between the Caribbean and Africa through the transatlantic slave trade and the imperialist influence that shaped the island into basically a landing mark for African people. So mm-hmm. Cuba believes it has a great debt that it needs to give back to Africa, and it still does so. I mean, Cuba today has around 60,000 Cubans working in Africa.
I was impressed with that number. You find that in the article. 60,000.
Yeah, 60,000. I come straight from the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the Peoples. Even after Cuba fulfilled one of its commitments, which was to end apartheid, it assisted in its assistance to Angola during the long, I think it was about 10 years or so that it spent fighting, over 10 years, 16 years it spent fighting alongside Angolans and other African peoples in that region. Struggling against the South African apartheid regime. So, mm-hmm. still to this day, what makes Cuba so interesting, I think, is to this day, we hear in the corporate media so much about how Cuba is turning capitalist and Cuba has all sorts of issues with race and, Cuba is a poor country that is so repressive. But when you go there, you don't see any of that. You see a country that despite losing billions of dollars per year because of U.S. sanctions, has managed to build a society that is egalitarian, that, you don't see things like people sleeping outside on the streets or begging because they don't have anywhere to go. It's funny, mm-hmm. I was speaking to the woman at the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the Peoples, and I asked, because there are people who ask you for money, and I asked about it, and she said, yeah, those people have places to go. If they want to participate in the revolution, they can. So it's almost like it's a different relationship than here in the United States, where, our rights are so rights to housing, to jobs, to, you know, the basic necessities of life are basically stripped from us from birth, and we have to sell our labor just to get them. In Cuba, basically those who do not want to participate in the revolution make it a choice to to like beg on the streets, and you barely see it. You see it, you know, I was only in Havana, but, you know, you see very so little of it. So it's a it really was a sight to see, because, you know, all throughout Havana and surrounding cities, there are monuments to international solidarity. And you can even see the integration that Cuba is kind of going through with China and Russia. You see a lot more kind of activity going on there economically. And, you know, the society is still struggling with, you know, relative poverty and underdevelopment. But all of the moves that it has made to speed up growth, economic growth, have all been to the benefit of the Cuban people. And it's so obvious, even with all the conversation about private capital coming in and tourism, the Cuban revolution remains very strong. And there was no sign that capitalism was coming back anytime soon.
We're speaking to Danny Haifong, whose article, Cuban Revolution Still in Motion, Black Agenda Report, Glenn Ford proprietor, excellent journal. And Danny has a number of great articles published there. You went to was it a museum of African revolutionaries? What was that? You were impressed very much with the museum.
It was funny. We were walking through, actually. We were in one of the more tourist-like areas of Havana. We were walking through. And at the end of it, I just happened to see a picture of Emil Kirkabral in the window. So I was just like, I need to go in there and see what's going on. It wasn't a store.
You could afford it, too. You weren't like an American tourist saying, I don't think we can afford that.
No, yeah, exactly. I just walked in, and what I noticed was that there were, murals and paintings throughout the room. It was just this big kind of hall, and it was filled with paintings and little vignettes about Cuba and its relationship with African revolutionaries, and some education about Kwame Nkrumah and Sékou Touré, and you name it, Julius Nyerere even. I mean, it was just a bunch of beautiful paintings of self-portraits, basically. And I asked, you know, my Spanish is terrible, but I asked, and I found out that it was a lot of the murals were donated. You could actually see in the corner it was donated by Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian.
Hugo Chavez?
The Bolivarian movement donated the paintings to Cuba as a gift. And so it was like a little museum. So basically, yeah, just things like that you can find all over Cuba because of how deep its history is of solidarity, and also how deeply that solidarity is embedded in Cuban culture at this point. I mean, I walked through Havana in the government district, and there's a Malcolm X, not a statue, but a portrait of his face carved into what looked like marble, and then Martin Luther King was there. So you could this is sort of an idea of what the Cuban people celebrate, right? Here in the United States, we celebrate imperialists and, you know, slave owners and days.
Gangsters.
To celebrate war. And in Cuba, they celebrate International Workers' Day and the July 26th movement and the anniversary of the revolution, as well as all of the revolutionaries around the world that they see as being a big part as to why they're able to enjoy what gains that they've been able to make under Cuban socialism. So it was a really interesting trip. I mean, the most interesting thing, honestly, was so the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the People had a pamphlet of information about what CENESEX, the Center for National Sex Education in Cuba, was doing. It was a campaign against homophobia and transphobia, and we had caught it at the end where they were having a big conga, a big rally to celebrate what I think was over a month-long campaign in the schools and in the neighborhood. To educate, you know, to reinforce all of the work that they've been doing. And there was this huge rally of dancing on the streets, no barricades, stopping buses in the middle of the streets of Havana. And these were like
No heavy police presence.
No heavy police presence. It was Afro-Cuban, queer, transgender, people of all stripes just dancing. And it's something you never see in the United States where, black people who identify as queer and trans and whatnot are heavily targeted by the state here. So it's just something that, are more likely to be homeless or, in prison than they are to be, dancing freely in the streets here. So that was maybe one of the more beautiful things that I got to see in Cuba in my short time.
This is Danny Haifeng, who was in Cuba. In the article, Cuba Revolution Still in Motion, Black Agenda Report. Incidentally, Danny, here we ask you these questions. You tell us this information. I certainly didn't read about this in the American newspapers, who claim to be great champions of gay rights and to be in favor of laws, et cetera, to protect people. They don't announce that Cuba's doing this, do they?
No, definitely not. I mean, the corporate media here in the United States is much more concerned about how to undermine the Cuban Revolution than it is with...
If there was an accident and someone was harmed, that we would hear about.
Yeah, for sure. Or, if one of their CIA spies had been able to pull something off at one of those, at the rally or... At one of any of the events that goes on in Cuba, that would be front page news about, the big resistance that's happening against the Cuban government by whatever, funded opposition that they have.
Yes.
And that's basically the story still. And, I think one of the laughable things and one of the questions I had for a lot of people was about race, because the New York Times, I don't know how many articles it's had over the last 2 years about how awful race relations are in Cuba, especially now that Cuba is allowing more semi-private and private capital to do some investment in order to grow the economy. It's an interesting conversation. The conversations that I was able to have with the Cuban Institute of French for the Peoples, I was also able to have a conversation with the editor, not the editor, the translator at the Grandma, and we asked this question about race. And the question and the issues that Cuba deals with race are so profoundly different than in the United States and in most of the Western world. I mean, we're talking about a revolution that is dedicated and that has in its leadership the promotion of international solidarity with Africa, as well as the mandate to ensure that any discrimination is met with the firmest possible response. And it's clear walking the streets of Cuba that, the revolution has brought the gains of socialism across the racial and class spectrum. So it's just interesting to hear how the corporate media still talks about Cuba, because even the things that have come up with some private dealings with hotels, hotels have some power in hiring in Cuba, especially the bigger, more chain hotels. And how Cuba still tries and does its best by, having co-management of these firms to ensure that, the revolution's values maintain in a very difficult period. This is a very difficult period for Cuba and for much of the world, given the state of the world, the capitalist economy, as well as the fact that socialism is not a fact in much of the world today.
Yeah. Now, in taking this to the issue, you point out, by the way, at the beginning of your article, that the U.S. actually owes Cuba damages. They owe a lot of people, of course, and they use blockades, they use sanctions. And this takes us to another matter that I think you write about very well, and I hope people will turn to Danny Haifeng's writings, Black Agenda Report, and elsewhere. I love the Internet. Just write Danny Haifeng, and you'll find out what he's thinking. But there's a... You address the issue of the inability of people of the so-called left of the North America and also across Europe to show solidarity with countries that are faced with these sanctions and blockades and intimidation. Let's say Venezuela right now. We read in you know, that these really sophisticated little Marxist so-called magazines like Jacobin, it's time to lecture the Venezuelans, time to straighten out their ideology, when actually it's time to show some solidarity. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. It's almost a laughable kind of development, because I think what it really reflects is the weakness in the state of the current movement here in the imperialist orbit. I mean, whether we're talking about the United States, Canada, the UK, across into Europe, I mean, there's a real need right now to build some powerful allies to the East, China, Russia, but also to build solidarity with those who have a special relationship with the United States and the West, and with that relationship being one of complete forced and imposed dependency by, you know, our own so-called government, right? And that's something that I think is a really hard concept for many here, especially in the United States, but this rings true for much of the Western world, is the fact that we are taught from the womb to the tomb that white makes right, and that our national identities are woven into this notion of white supremacy, and how, you know, we are an exceptional people compared to peoples that have been historically exploited by our own ruling classes.
Mm-hmm.
And this poses big problems when the state of the left movement, the radical and revolutionary movements, are weak, because formations that do happen to exist and are able to have the resources and the ability to get information out on a mass basis, or even a semi-mass basis, if we can talk about Jacobin, I don't consider them huge, but they do have a pretty big readership, and partly that's because their mode of politics is very useful, and I feel like those who get the most airtime, the most access to certain resources, are those, whether they have internal infiltration, if we want to get into that, from the state or not, mm-hmm. it still happens that their politics end up reinforcing the very ideas and narratives that allow U.S. imperialism to do things like support an opposition at about 2 to 5 million per year in Venezuela, which is responsible for dozens and dozens and dozens, not hundreds, of just brutal murders and, you know, hoardings of economic material goods that are a necessity for the Bolivarian Revolution to survive. And, you know, what we're seeing is the left here in the West unable to grasp the class character, and also the racial and the social relations that are based in
the
race.
Definition of left has to involve internationalism, our common humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone says, well, I have a bone to pick with the leadership of Venezuela, you could say, well, if you're living in the United States, the first bone you'd have to pick is the damn blockade, right? And
yeah.
sanctions,
yeah.
economic sanctions.
Thanks.
Then you could be permitted to join other conversations. But
mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, exactly. We have to realize, and, you know, magazines like Jacobin and many others seem not to realize that if you're not struggling against what your imperialist government is doing, what your imperialist powers that have a vested interest in not only exploiting the peoples all over the world, but a vested interest in keeping people in your own country exploited and oppressed, poor. You know, we see a crisis here in the mainlands of imperialism that will only be exacerbated if we find ourselves on the opposite end of history, if we find ourselves totally unable to forge solidarity with people in Syria, people in Venezuela, people all over the world who are saying, we are choosing our sovereign destinies. Now it's your turn in the United States to turn your gaze around. Don't look at us unless you're helping us. I think that should be the message that the left in the United States and the West takes to heart, is that don't try to help the people of the world, if you're not fighting racism in the United States, if you're not fighting the exploitation of working people in the United States, don't cast your gaze abroad until you understand the connection mm-hmm. between what's going on both in your country and in the countries that are so ravaged by the imperialist system.
Yeah. Well, Danny Haifong, that's a perfect note. We thank you very, very much for joining us. We always look forward to your writing.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okie doke. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.